Hi, Steve Cooper, Rank Success, and this is just a short intro to my next podcast, which is an interview with Paul Davis, a former Assistant Chief Constable who retired after 34 years service in policing. And in that we cover quite a lot of ground, quite a lot of material. So I talked to Paul about being on both sides of the promotion interview as he's progressed through the ranks, and he shares some of the secrets of his successes and failures. And we also talk about whether the promotion system is fair or not, and some perceptions around that. We cover neurodiversity and also the proposals to remove the front-end legal exam under SIP, the College of Policing's proposals and initiative. We talk about interviews, whether they're relevant, and some views that Paul shares around whether interviews are relevant to selection processes for promotion. And we also talk about performance management, and I asked Paul where he believes the balance lies for effective performance management and some of the previous regimes and the current regime and thinking around that. We touched very quickly on politicisation of policing and the situation or zeitgeist with that. And then we also cover policing leadership and standards and some of the comments around the HMIC State of Policing Report from 2022. And finally, a couple of personal views around what Paul has personally seen in the attributes of leaders and people that he considered to be good leaders and what it was about them. So quite a lot of information in relation to that. I am going to do a very short advert in a minute, and then we'll get straight stuck into the podcast. And if you want to share some of your views, if you'd like to be interviewed or take part in the blog, just let me know and we can go from there. Okay, so just a short blog and we'll short advert, and then we'll get into the content of this interview. At Rank Success, I'm committed to giving you the best police leadership development, levelling the playing field of promotion, whatever your budget and wherever you are. I invite you to explore my free blogs at policepromotion.blog and videos on my YouTube channel. There's topical police news, salary information, deep dives into diversity, CVF explainers, explanations of promotion assessments, and various aspects covering your police leadership and ongoing CPD. All this content will firstly help you become a better police leader, and then secondly, succeed in your promotion process. To go further, you might consider becoming a subscriber of my podcast. Not only will you be supporting the free content I create for others, but for just $4.99 a month, you'll also get extra subscriber-only episodes. You'll be the first to access all new episodes and have access to the best of my back catalogue, whilst also getting an exclusive 25% discount on my market-leading promotion materials. There's no commitment, and you can cancel any time. Want to smash your promotion with tried and tested prep? If you've got an upcoming board or you just want to get ahead of the competition now, consider my structured, succinct and rank-specific toolkits. These help focus your effort on the right things, including examples of what good evidence looks like, explainers of the CVF, plus a myriad of other essential content to help you achieve your aspiration. Others have described these materials as a godsend, like gold dust, helping to tame the monsters in your mind, and have even stated there's nothing else like it. See countless more testimonials on my website from successful cops who took action and got in touch. There's e-guides, my professional recorded masterclass video, plus my in-depth CVF explainer video, or indeed special bundle offers on everything. Or come join me for an all-inclusive day on my next in-person promotion masterclass. All this and more is available from my main website at ranksuccess.co.uk. And the return on investment will come in your first month's salary increase alone. So that's an overview of what I can do for you. And without further ado, let's get into today's podcast. Okay, my guest today is Paul Davis, who's a former Assistant Chief Constable. And I'm going to start by getting straight into it and asking Paul to introduce himself. Morning, Paul.
Morning, Steve. Good to see you. My name is Paul Davis. I'm retired from policing. I retired in 2020. After 30 years service, I started with Inner Somerset Police back in the early 90s. and then transferred to Devon and Cornwall, and from there managed to go through the ranks from constable to assistant chief constable, primarily in operational command roles, local policing area commander as both a chief inspector and superintendent, and then assistant chief constable for my last few years of service, with the responsibility for local policing partnerships and operations at the time, a portfolio that's now been split. So that's me.
Thanks very much, Paul. Thanks for that. And you've been on both sides of the promotion interview table as you've progressed your own career, I'm sure, many times through the ranks. So what advice would you offer listeners aspiring to leadership positions who have promotion opportunities upcoming?
Okay, so a couple of issues there for me. So first thing, if you're offered an opportunity, then take it and make the very most of it. And just specifically around, for example, temporary promotion. I always advise people, if you're given the opportunity for temporary promotion or an acting opportunity, treat it as your own, because there's nothing worse than seeing somebody who has been given a temporary opportunity and then acquiesces to, well, I'm only in a temporary role, so I can't really make the decisions I would make if I had this role substantively. So make the most of it, take the opportunity and treat it as your own. With regards to leadership more broadly, I think in policing, sometimes leadership can be seen as rank-based. And for me, leadership is far broader than that. So a lot of the best leaders I worked with as a serving police officer were at constable rank or were members of police staff who really are not part of that rank-based hierarchical system that most police officers who go for promotion are. So it's not rank-based. Leadership is far broader than that. But I think our discussion today is going to be primarily based around rank because, I'm talking to the lead for rank success. So if it comes to promotion and developing and displaying your leadership through promotion, then the strapline, I hate straplines, but I'll use one, I would use and have used and did use, during my time on the Strategic Command course, was know yourself, know what's expected of you, and have a plan. So if I could just go through those in a bit more
detail. Yeah, please do.
So if you choose to display and develop your leadership through promotion, and that's not the only way to display leadership, then the first question I think you should ask yourself, because it's all about self-awareness for me, is why me? And the answer to that, as I've said, requires a real sort of increased sense of self-awareness, a level of honesty with yourself as an individual, and a level of emotional intelligence that allows you to understand really what other people think of you. So, and the questions I posed myself when I was determining whether to go further through the promotion, through the rank system, as I did, is, okay, what qualities do you possess in the role that you're already in and the level of the organisation you're currently operating in, but also what qualities do you possess, more importantly, if you're going for a promotion, for that next rank in the system and that more senior level within the organisation? What drives you as an individual? Promotion is a voluntary process. Nobody is making anybody go for promotion. It's voluntary. So you, I think, and because of the impact that that can have on your personal and professional life, you really need to have an understanding as to why you're putting yourself through that. What quality do you possess? What drives you? Why should people buy into what you're offering? Why should they follow you? Why should people be led by you? Why now? Why is now the right time for you to be going into a process that will determine whether your promotion to the next rank, whether you're ready for that at this moment in time? Why now? Should it be a bit later? Or is it the right time to go for it now? What kind of leader are you? And what I don't like to see is when you ask people what their leadership style is, they'll just default and say, well, I'm, predominantly transformational, but, I can tip into transactional when I want. I want a bit more than that. I want to understand the individual. What kind of leader are you? And does that align with what the organisation requires from you as a leader? Do people see you as a leader? That emotional intelligence that says, when I walk into a room, what do people think of me? Because if you think they see a really good, well-respected leader, but in reality they really do not, they see something far different, well, maybe your emotional intelligence radar is slightly off-kilter and it's something you need to look at. So it's that sort of self-awareness, that understanding as to why you're putting yourself through that process, an oversubscribed process, that far, far more people than are required are going into, and a competitive process that I'm sure we'll come on to later on in the discussion. And I think aspiring leaders need to have, should have that level of self-awareness. And they should be able to articulate that quite easily because that's naturally where their mindset is. I hope that makes sense. So that's know yourself. I then think you need to know what's expected of you. And that's not just around a specific process that you're going into. So in this context, what are the expectations of leaders within your organization? That might be a statement of intent from the chief constable. It might be outlined in the vision and the mission of an organization. But can you align with those expectations of leaders? Because they will change. They will subtly change because that's within, you know, the autonomy of a chief constable, and some will have a different style to others. If you can't sign up to them, you're probably going into the wrong process. And then your understanding of the exact process that has been put in place for a specific promotion to whatever rank. So you need to understand the process, what's required from the process. If it's a promotion board, interview board, what are the board expecting to see from those candidates who are successful? You need to understand all of that. And I think there's a lot of preparation you can do to ensure that you have that understanding going into a process. And finally, I think, as part of the strap line, have a plan. Now, that plan shouldn't just be pulled off the shelf when the applications for a promotion process land. This should be an ongoing, intrinsic part of your CPD. And very often what I used to see with officers and police staff is you pay lip service to that because it's in addition to, it's seen as an addition to a busy day job. Well, actually, that should be an intrinsic part of your overall self-development as you go forward. So have a plan. You don't have to share that plan with anybody. I used to tell people who are mentored, you might want to share it with me as your mentor, but actually have a plan. And that's not a plan to get to the next rank. That is a bit of more of a broader career plan as to why you, do you have the right self-awareness? Do you know enough about yourself? And do you know enough about what is expected of leaders within the organization that you're in? And your plan should sort of encompass all of that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And you talked earlier on, Paul, about going through all those boards yourself. You said that you've been unsuccessful at almost every rank that you went for. Could you tell me a little bit about that? Because I think learning from setbacks is an important thing as well, part of your journey, isn't it?
So I may be retired, and everything I say is caveated on the basis that I did leave the service over 3 years ago. But in this regard, I do think my history around promotion through the police service qualifies me to put forward a view. So I failed at every single rank at least once. So PC the Sergeant, I failed on two occasions at the written application stage. And even after taking feedback, I still failed at that stage on the second attempt. That caused me to transfer forces. That wasn't the only reason. I had personal reasons because I'd met my wife in training. So I moved to Devon and Cornwall. I then managed to get to Sergeant. I failed Sergeant to Inspector. On one occasion, I failed Inspector the Chief Inspector the Superintendent, Superintendent the Chief Superintendent, and I failed really quite miserably at my first attempt at PNAC, the Police National Assessment Centre, that at the time was, qualified you to go onto the Strategic Command course. Now, I don't know many people, and I have challenged audiences in the past when I've served, I don't know many people who have been unsuccessful that many times through promotion procedures. So I have learned from that. I have reflected on that over a lengthy period of time, for most of my career, actually, because for most of my career, I was reflecting on a failure in order to go back and subsequently get through on the following occasion, which, as I've just outlined, I did. So I have an opinion, and I have got a view on this, and hopefully I can just run through that, Steve. Please come back if you wish. Fairness in the process. For me, fairness is very subjective. And when it comes to specific promotion processes, where if you are unsuccessful, it really does impact on you. It impacts on you, your family, your view of yourself within the organization, because, none of this is done on the quiet. Everybody knows that you've been unsuccessful, and that's something you have to deal with. But fairness is very subjective and is often a very personal perspective and perception based on your individual circumstance. So over many years, I would have seen people who question the fairness of promotion processes. Okay. Now, frankly, when I failed promotion at every single rank, I didn't always consider that process was fair.
Mm-hmm.
But when I reflect, when I was subsequently successful at every single rank, up to the rank of assistant chief constable, I didn't once question the fairness of the process. Very rarely do you see people who are successful through a process questioning the fairness of it. The point being, it's very subjective and it's competitive. And if it's competitive, there are always going to be those who are successful, those who are unsuccessful, and that will shape their view of the process. Having said that, it's really, really important that organisational justice, and in the case of promotion processes, procedural justice, is seen to be an important factor of the overall process. What I would say on the other side of the process, as you alluded to, I have sat on countless promotion boards through most ranks, up to and including chief superintendent. And what I would say to those who question the fairness of the process, whether you feel the process that's been put in place is the right one, is a different debate. We can debate that if you wish. But when you question the fairness of the process, what I would say is, having been involved on both sides of the table, is if I had ever felt that those processes were inherently unfair, had a predetermined outcome for particular candidates or a certain type of personality, and was not a level playing field that applied equality of opportunity, then I wouldn't have allowed myself as a senior leader with integrity and values to be part of that process. And I can't think of any promotion board I've sat on where anybody else would have allowed that either. And the fact that most boards would have an independent HR specialist who, if they're worth their money, wouldn't allow that to happen anyway. But it was never an issue for me sat on those boards. It was very clear, you know, the process has been agreed. Whether you agree with the process or not is a different debate. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean, if you think it's the wrong process, it doesn't mean it's unfair. It probably is deemed unfair by people who, frankly, have been unsuccessful. And that's because it's a very subjective view. So that's what I would say about the fairness of the process. What is the right process? Well, some standardisation, I think, nationally would help.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem to be a bit of a postcode lottery. I think they're words you've used yourself. Promotion is oversubscribed. You know, every process is oversubscribed. I think some forces, with regards to PC and Sergeant, have done away with any form of interview board. I have a view on that. We can discuss if you wish. But at all ranks, it's oversubscribed. So there will always need to be a process to funnel those large number of individuals who, many of whom, will do a good job if they're promoted. But they probably outnumber the opportunities and the requirements that the organisation has. Forces have a real responsibility to do what is required for that process to be seen as fair, and also for that process to be understood. So that even if candidates are unsuccessful, they can still align to the fact that it was a fair process. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And in terms of an interview, Paul, being part of the process, whatever the process is, what are your thoughts about not interviewing or not interviewing at certain ranks? And do you think it's, you know, at what level would you think it's inconceivable to use an to promote someone without interviewing them within the police service?
So I sat on interview boards for every rank. Some of those ranks had an additional requirement to look at practical scenarios, almost like a mini PNAC sort of setup, certainly for Chief Superintendent in Devonport. And I've always had the view, actually, that an interview board should be a requirement for promotion to all ranks. The reason being, there has to be some process put in place. PC to Sergeant is slightly different in that, in some cases, the projections for numbers is not matched by the people coming through. But most ranks, it's oversubscribed. So you need a process to be put in place. And for me to sit down in front of a panel of peers, they may be more senior peers, but they are peers, to sit down in front of a panel of peers and be able to articulate why you, in a structured interview, why you are the right person to be successful in this process, I think is a requirement of showing yourself as suitable for that promotion. And we can talk about reasonable adjustments and so on and so forth, because they're very standardised and well-known HR practices that allow that reasonable adjustment and equality opportunity to be apparent and in place, and absolutely quite right, it should be. But if you're not going to interview people, what other process are you going to use? And I don't see any other process that, for me, is any more credible.
Okay, and things like neurodiversity, which is, you know, suddenly seems that every organisation in the world has woke up and smelt the coffee around people with dyslexia, dyspraxia, on the autistic spectrum, and they bring a particular set of skills, sometimes with numbers, graphs, computer programs and skills. And do you think that having an interview as a essential component of a promotion process that might disadvantage some of those people, because there's a lot of focus on that at the moment?
So I think my view on that is so increased recognition of neurodiversity across society, actually, not just across policing, is leading to and has led to increased understanding by organisations in respect to ensuring equality of opportunity is apparent in any of their processes, be that for promotion or just a selection and so on and so forth. You know, forces have a legal obligation. Most forces would align to a moral obligation in respect to fairness of process, in respect to fairness of policy, and in respect to applying reasonable adjustments that should be made pretty clear from the outset and should be ingrained into all of your workforce processes. So I don't buy the idea that that you can't apply fairness of opportunity and reasonable adjustments to deal with some of the issues that you mentioned. What I do think needs further work is the cultural understanding and acceptance of the broader workforce as to why some candidates would require reasonable adjustments. And I think that, for me, is still a work in progress. And I say that as somebody who's left the service over 3 years ago. But if you'd been asking me 3.5 years ago when I was serving, it's that cultural bit that still is a work in progress and still needs some work. But you know, these are now standardised HR practices across all organisations. All organisations have to deal with neurodiversity and have to put in processes, policies, structures, procedures. For me now, that should be a standardised HR process.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Paul. And can I just switch now to something that was mentioned in the Casey review, where they observed that the promotion system wasn't fair or based on merit, and this particular kind of focus on there was those who succeeded tended to be those who were good at passing tests or working the system. It rewards the ability to learn the right answers. And you've said a lot there. Essentially, their focus of criticism is around merit and broad observations from that particular review that said it didn't appear to be fair. What are your thoughts on that? I know you've covered a lot of it, but in relation to the Casey perspective on that.
So, I take on board the view and the recommendations from Casey. I think policing needs to actually come back and give a view on the recommendations, particularly around Casey. I don't think I've seen any survey or any staff discussion or any staff feedback session where there will be an element of people, many of whom have been through the process, not all of whom have been through a promotion process, who will come back and say to the organisation, we feel that this process is unfair. And that takes me right back to my initial comment. This is a very subjective view. Mm-hmm. I failed 7 or 8 promotion processes, and I can assure you it's human nature, and it was human nature for me to think, you know what, this process sucks. Yeah. Well, the bottom line is, this is oversubscribed. This is therefore a competitive process. There will be people who are successful, and there will be people who are unsuccessful. The organisation has a responsibility to ensure that the processes that they agree on are inherently fair and provide fairness of opportunity and provide reasonable adjustments where they're required. They also have a responsibility to ensure that those who are unsuccessful get the right level of feedback, meaningful feedback, and get any support that they require, because, you know, it's quite an impactive thing to be unsuccessful in the promotion process. So I've gone off script somewhere.
No, I think you're quite right there, because the reason I ask you some of that is because I know from speaking to officers going for various different ranks in various different processes across different forces that they don't always get feedback after a process. Some of it, it doesn't exist. Other times it's pretty bland. And there doesn't seem to be the same effort going into really keen people who do want to subject themselves to the process, that perhaps should come away from that experience with a more uplifting kind of feeling. Say, yes, I've disappointed. Yes, I've been unsuccessful, but they put me on a development plan. Yes. I've had a meaningful chat with a senior manager who actually appears to care about me and my career progression and has given me some top tips, paired me up with a mentor, or give me some meaningful advice. Say, well, you said this, but you didn't say it in the right way, or you didn't actually display a strategic awareness for the level of the rank you got for inspector or chief inspector. And that came across to us. So what you could have said was more about this, and I think it's just the quality of the feedback.
And I think that responsibility post the process is as important to the process itself. So I recall, you know, and I'm going back 25 years when I was first sat on promotional processes that I failed numerous times. Some of the feedback was, you know, yeah, thanks for coming, try again next time. You might want to consider moving role. Well, thanks for that. It's really meaningful. I made a point whenever I sat on a promotion board to offer myself personally to give feedback to candidates, which is a big chunk of your diary time if everybody takes you up on that opportunity. And the reason I did that was, for me, that was as important a responsibility as a board member as sitting the boards in the first place. You know, and that feedback should be meaningful. For some people, that feedback will be nothing more than, you just need to develop in this area, this area, this area. And that's perfectly natural at this stage of your progression. And it's nothing to feel, you will obviously feel disappointed because that's human nature. But that's nothing to feel too despondent about, because actually that's quite promising. It's showing that you've got the talent, you've got the potential, you just need to work on it a bit more, because this is an oversubscribed process and there are more people wanting to get through this than the organisation requires. Now, that's not bad feedback. That's actually positive stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Saying you're ready. You know, we think you'll get there, but you're just not quite there yet. It's when that none of that is offered, that's when I think there's an organisational failing and a failing of individual board members. Because if you're signing up to run the board, you should also sign up for the entirety of the process, which does require providing those who are successful as well, but primarily those who are unsuccessful, with some meaningful feedback that they can actually work with. And that might be consider lateral development, because you're never going to get promoted.
Where
to be frank, if they're difficult decisions, you know, conversations that need to be had, then have them.
Yeah.
So long as they're based on evidence.
And they'll be appreciated, I'm sure, at a very personal level. So just one of the other things I wanted to touch on around the fairness of promotion and getting through the whole process from start to kind of finish, or certainly achieving the next rank that you attend. You intend to achieve. The College of Policing has recently proposed something called the Sergeants Inspectors Progression and Promotion System, called SIP. And part of that is proposing to remove the legal exam from the front end of the process and putting it at the end of the process and having people sit through online stuff, portfolio development, but being promoted once they express an interest and they meet obviously some criteria into the post, developing the post for a while, and then take something that is not yet decided. It may be a legal knowledge check, but there seems to be a view that the exam itself is a barrier to progression. And I know it's been there for, you know, as long as I can remember, but what are your thoughts about that? There was a bit of a kerfuffle, if I can say that, but it's now been kicked down the road, if you like, a couple of years, and then it'll be presented to the National Police Chiefs Council as something more concrete and substantial and tangible. But what are your thoughts on that?
So I think having that national standardised benchmark right at the beginning of any process, for me, works. And that comes with all the caveats that if people require reasonable adjustments and so on to go into that examination process, then that, again, as I've said, it should be a standardised HR addition. But for me, that standardised benchmark is important and does work. And again, we should never forget that these are oversubscribed promotion processes. So if that's a barrier to progression, it's clearly not affecting numbers that much because all of the processes are oversubscribed. If it's a barrier for progression for certain individuals who might have certain protected characteristics, well, I'll revert back to there are standardized HR practices and processes in place to make sure reasonable adjustments are put in place and also positive action to try and, you know, give those candidates, a lift into the process. I'm not sure what the evidence base is that the college are using to assert that this is a barrier for progression. And I would suggest if it was that much of a barrier to progression, it's a disservice for the college to kick this issue 2 years down the line before it's even discussed around the table. So I'm going off script again somewhat, but I agree there should be a standardised benchmark by virtue of the fact that all of these processes are oversubscribed. And actually, it does show that people have the aptitude for professional development, developments that is relevant to the role that they wish to undertake in the future. And therefore, that investment of time, which is primarily what their investment is, and in some cases a bit of cost, but that investment of time shows that they are, they want to get themselves into the best possible position for that further progression. And, this is not meant to be an easy process. This is meant to get the best people, the most talented people, to the positions of leadership within the service. So it shouldn't be seen as easy. I don't buy into all of this lowering of standards stuff to any great extent, but I also think that if this stuff is challenging, that's not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Does any of that make sense?
Absolutely. I think anybody who's been through the process will agree it's challenging. I think some of the smaller aspects around it are when you look at some of the discrepancies around forces. Some forces will provide Blackstone's manuals for their,
yes,
or subsidise the cost of them.
Yes.
Some will subsidise the cost of attendance on a crammer course for people and subsidise the cost of that. But others won't, and others will give protected study time for that, and others won't or can't.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did a review for the University of South Wales around their PCDA and DHEP entrance, mm-hmm. and the protected learning time was one of the recurring themes that came through that across a number of forces. That inconsistency, which is not just pertinent to this issue we're talking about, that inconsistency across forces, I think, is a weakness within the 43. Force system of UK policing. Mm-hmm. It's not the only weakness. There are a lot of strengths as well within that system, but it is one of the inherent weaknesses, is that inconsistency in just providing that standardised expectation of what's required to progress through the service. Mm-hmm. And as you said already, it's that postcode lottery of process, of requirements, of assistance and support that's provided does a disservice, I think, to the officers and staff who want to put themselves through those processes.
Hmm. Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of listeners that kind of agree with a lot of what you just said there. I just wanted to move on to the topic of performance management. And I know I've given you a couple of notes that I wanted to cover that we went through. And there is a Policy Exchange report that sets the tone and says, British policing is in crisis. 1 in 7 of 43 police forces of England and Wales have now been placed in special measures or engage, as they call it now.
It's an interesting way to, 1 in 7 of 43. I mean, why not just say it's the 5 or 6 forces,
And I think it's less than that now. By HMIC, collapsing public confidence and a non-existent performance regime. There are some other kind of observations I've put in there around about 10 years ago, performance appeared to be reflecting the American CompStat type approach or elements or ingredients of it. Some managers at junior and senior levels had unpleasant experiences, shall we say, at being called in to be accountable for their department's management. And when you look at things like Bill Bratton CompStat and those kind of decades around that, it's definitely about tightening up and being accountable at the level of the rank you're going for. But could you just share some of your perspectives on where you believe the balance lies for effective performance management and, if necessary, at different ranks of accountability?
Yes, yeah, I can. Yeah. Now, I as a relatively young in service superintendent, not young in service, a young in rank superintendent. Sorry, excuse me, my.
Sorry. That's okay. You know, it's disappeared off the screen. Technology.
Yeah, isn't it? Okay. So as a young in rank superintendent, I lived through the nearest we got to a Comstat approach. I'm going back to probably 12 years under two very different deputy chief constables at the time. So one is a superintendent, one is a chief superintendent. I call it Comstat Light because neither of those deputy chief constables was really nasty enough to truly apply a Comstat approach. So, you know, from the very outset, it was challenging, but, you know, with a bit of a cover blanket, shall we say. I agree that in any position of responsibility, if you have an area of responsibility, a department, a BC, whatever it may be, you should be accountable for understanding your business. You should be accountable for understanding what your key threats are, what you're doing about those threats, and how effective is your tasking and coordination process if it's to do with operational issues, and how you are collectively coming together with other senior leaders, whether that you're the one with the specific performance issue or they are, how you're collectively coming together to achieve the optimum results, which at the end of the day is providing the best service that you possibly can. So having been through that concept, what I would disagree with, that Comstat approach, what I would disagree with was the often ridiculous way that played out. And you've alluded to some of it, you know, what appeared to be the ritual humiliation of commanders, an expectation for commanders to be right into the weeds of literally crime statistics on a daily basis, you know, which takes them away from, frankly, the strategic element of their day job, I would argue. You know, staring at the table at, you know, performance management meetings as other colleagues were, you know, shall we say, ripped to pieces, often on the back of data and analysis that, you know, at best was sketchy. Very often, nobody really understood. So I don't buy into that approach at all. I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think it gives you the long-term improvements that you want. What it does give you is a disaffected middle management level of your organisation. And I actually think with the new generation of senior officers coming through those middle levels, forces wouldn't get away with that approach. I just don't think it would be sustainable. What I do think is austerity and that period of austerity, which there were some benefits to that. It wasn't all really bad stuff. There were some benefits to that. So I'm not making a political point. But austerity changed that performance management regime exponentially, I would argue, to the point where when I left the service, that sort of performance management accountability was pretty much non-existent, I would suggest, and had been for several years. And it's, I think, the case that you now have a generation of senior leaders for whom performance management on that sort of granular level has not been a key focus and a key accountability for them. But I do think there needs to be a bit of a rebalancing, not least because that approach to performance management needs to change because of the political imperative that comes with an uplift of 20,000 officers. So, as a specific example, the Home Secretary sits before the National Policing Board last week and gives the senior leadership, you know, the people running UK policing, a bit of a rollick in respect to getting back to basics and all of that, whatever that might mean. Mm-hmm. You know, it's clearly apparent and utterly predictable, I think, that if you have an investment of 20,000 officers and an uplift of 20,000 officers, that comes with some payback. That payback is a political imperative to apply more focus in specific areas, getting back to basis, you know, clamping down on crime, whatever it might be. Mm. And that will trickle down. And as that trickles down, that will require a mindset that is more attuned to performance management in a more granular level than most of your current superintendents and chief superintendents have been used to over the past 10 years.
And what did you think of the comment in the, I think it was the Policy Exchange report that said it was proposed, and I mean, it almost sounded like Bill Bratton had written it. There's a case for bringing in a whole new regime of young, up-and-coming, thrusting, performance-based managers and removing those that have effectively failed to date. What do you think of that? I know it's a report. It's easy to write those comments, but does that mirror what you've just said?
It might be a report, but it's sort of based largely on ignorance, Steve. And that's my problem with this. So some of this nonsense, really. You can't get rid of them. These are... So by the very nature that they're police officers and you can't make them redundant. So when you say get rid of them, what exactly do you mean? You put them in a room somewhere where they're still earning their salary, but they're not doing anything constructive. You cannot blame senior leaders for coming through a system that has applied its focus elsewhere. And austerity and officer uplift has applied that focus elsewhere for the last decade. What you need to do is almost sort of re-chip's the wrong word, but give those senior leaders an understanding as to the requirement for policing to be more accountable through its performance management regime, and that will require an accountability from those senior leaders who have voluntarily put themselves in those positions. So the idea you can just get rid of these people and bring through this some sort of utopian battalion of performance-minded. Where are they currently then? It just cheapens the debate. This is my problem with this stuff. There should be mature debate around this. It is utterly predictable that an investment of 20,000 officers in policing will bring more focus around performance management, will bring more political imperative around where performance management should be focused and areas of crime and criminal justice where the police should focus their attentions. That's utterly predictable based on an investment of 20,000. It's not beyond the realms of the current crop of senior leaders to attune the way they operate to factor that in, because they're going to have to. But some off-the-cuff comments from people who largely don't really know what they're talking about when it comes down to basic things like the term and conditions of police officers, cheapens the debate. I'm sorry. It gives them less credibility in what they're saying than the credibility of the senior leaders in policing, who will have to attune to this more focused performance management regime.
And like I said, there's a lot of information, a lot of comments like that around at the moment, and a lot of reports for officers to read, and they don't always read them when they go for promotion. So one of the things that I observed today, in fact, that I'm told, and certainly when I do some of the promotion masterclasses and events that I do, I ask people what they're reading, what they've read, how they are improving, if you like. And there seems to be this, if it's not a personal hobby or habit to read, there's a kind of hop, skip and a jump through material.
Yeah.
And that's where I think a lot of these notable paragraphs are jumping out at people, that when I do ask them what they're saying, well, I read this and I heard this, rather than reading a broad brush of material. So one of the things I just wanted to come back to quickly was, you mentioned about, the Home Secretary, the political imperative. Do you think there's any increased, some people say also there's a increased politicisation of policing today. To what extent do you think that is relevant or a meaningful observation?
So,
well, that's a loaded question.
It is a bit. I'm going to keep this brief. And what I don't want this to be seen as is some sort of party political rant, because it's not. I have views. This is nothing to do with that. I'm in a position now where, having been involved in policing from the age of 17 as a military policeman through to retirement some 34 years later, being involved on a day-to-day basis. And actually, when you retire, you step away from that. You're no longer involved on a day-to-day basis. And you actually get to see, in an untainted way, how policing is viewed by the general public, which, bizarrely, I've been a member of the general public the entire time I was in the police, but you just don't view it. You view it in a different way. And what I see currently, I see a society that is changing, and very often not in a great, not in a positive sense, a society that is becoming more polarised, more fractured, more digitalised, and the whole issue of around how organisations, not just policing, deal with this 24/7 media frenzied, immediate news being pumped out there, then gaining an immediate response before organisations have even had time to think about what their own response might be to issues. So you've got all that playing out in society. You then have the politicisation of policing that has always been apparent, I think, but I sense is now more apparent than it's ever been. It strikes me that, you know, this country's been in election footing, almost, you know, perpetual election campaigning going on. And I think policing really needs to understand what its position within both society and in respect to politics within policing really needs to understand where it fits. And I suppose my concern is that the policing is somehow getting lost in those shouting loudest, both within a fractured society that is more polarised. You only have to look at, you know, protests marching in London on a weekend to realise that there is a polarisation, you know, of views within society, not least exacerbated by the whole digital agenda and social media and so on. So this all is this maelstrom of angst, and policing sits in the middle of that. You know, if society is fractured, policing sits right in the middle of that. We saw that in the late 70s, early 80s with Brixton riots, sus laws and Scarman and so on. So policing needs to understand what its position there is. Mm-hmm. And I think if I look at the Met Police currently, for the last couple of months, I think their communications around some of this stuff has upped the level. You know, they're proactively trying to, you know, come back at, you know, constant criticism from all sides of the both the political debate and societal debate. I think the Met are now switching on to this, and in the last few months there's been almost a tangible difference in the way they're proactively responding to that. I think the rest of the service quickly needs to follow suit.
Well, they've definitely recruited some good communication.
Well, this is the point, you see. You know, in a digitalised age with 24/7 news, policing needs to, you know, invest as much in its corporate communications and the right people and the people with the right networks, etc. That's a fundamentally, for me, important part of the service. I made the comment earlier before we were recording, you know, at the moment, so for somebody outside looking in, it can appear that policing, and at the most senior levels of policing, and this is not meant as a criticism, it's an observation, but will sound like a criticism, is in danger of rolling over and getting its tummy tickled by a society that doesn't really agree what it wants from policing, and by politicians who are increasingly stretching the independent operational interference that we're seeing and we see on an almost daily basis. And when it comes to leadership at all levels, that affects, I think, from a sergeant and inspector and their relationship with their local parish, town, district councillors, elected officials, those community leaders, so on and so forth. That affects them as well as it affects your superintendents, chief superintendents who are, you know, dealing with strategic partnerships, dealing with elected officials, all of whom are, you know, looking at an election cycle that is coming to fruition, PCCs and the relationship with PCCs, and it goes right the way through then. And as I've said, you know, the Home Secretary effectively pitching up at the National Police Board, giving the senior people in policing a bit of a rollicking. That's how it's reported, that they've been ordered to get back to basics. Policing needs to respond to that. I don't know, I don't have all of the answers here. You know, we live in a democracy and elected officials are there as representatives of the people who have elected them. So policing shouldn't have to get into the politicisation debate. But when it's dragged in, and I think it is increasingly dragged into that political debate, it needs to have a response. And at the moment, even that response is not there, and I don't think it is. Or if it is there, it's not being heard.
No, and thanks very much for sharing some of that. I appreciate it was a bit of a loaded question, and I know you've got some good views there, but there's also some good threads and thoughts and issues there for people who are intent on getting promoted and who aspire to promotion through the ranks to pick up on and develop their thinking with. So,
well, it's the broader thinking for me, and this is, you know, this comes, and we'll probably touch upon strategic awareness. What do we mean by that? We can probably touch on that. But it's the broader awareness for me that I think. And I've always felt this, you know, this is not a retired old boy having a rant. And I'm certainly not critical of people who are now in the job doing a difficult job in really difficult circumstances. It's always been my view that, you know, that broader strategic awareness has been lacking. not only within policing, but across the public sector in the UK, I think. And I think we just need to up our game with that. I say we, because, you know, even though I've been out of the service for 30 years, I care deeply about it. And, you know, I'm still almost, you know, converse in a way that, you know, suggests I'm still involved. I'm not. But when I look in and I see policing and the reputation of UK policing, which I would contend is amongst the best in the world, being routinely trashed without any real proactive comeback on a collective basis, I think we're missing a trick. Policing is missing a trick.
Okay.
And unless something fills that void, it will only get worse.
Well, I think there'll be quite a few people who do choose to listen to this and to listen to your views and to listen to your responses and these questions, because they're all part of, and the whole idea about this is for people who want to be impressive and to be able to demonstrate and articulate their own thinking as aspiring leaders on promotion boards. I think it's important that they listen to this kind of thing. It's precisely why I'm interviewing you. And I think for some of those reasons there's something for everyone, whether they're going for sergeant, inspector, chief inspector, superintendent. Hopefully there's something there for everyone to kind of fire their grappling hooks into and think around and develop, and perhaps convert that into what they do when they get promoted and how they behave.
None of that was meant as a criticism of those who are undertaking a really difficult role.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been out as well for 10 years, and I look in from time to time, would I want to ever dip my toe in? I've got most of my family, I've got about 5 or 6 family members serving at the moment, so I kind of do have those touch base and finger on the pulse moments.
Well, similarly, I have family members, you know, PCSO.
That's right, someone at the door, Paul. That's okay, go on.
That's unfortunate.
So go away, like, edit that bit out or leave it in. Depending who's at the door.
Thank you. Something been delivered, I've no idea what. Where were we?
So what I was going to say, I just said there's something there for everybody. And what I wanted to do is just while we're on that is to look at policing leadership and standards. I wanted to come back to some of the standards in policing that have been observed and commented on by the Chief HMIC in the State of Policing report. And some of the comments there are quite big. So, yeah, as you allude to, you know, it's difficult for those in the job. There's rising demand, challenges, workloads. The experience is leaving in terms of retention and recruitment. That's a difficult battle. Budgets are always challenged. Wellbeing is a big issue in amongst all that. Paying conditions is there as well. But HMIC also alludes to standards. And it says here that the police service needs to improve the way in which it identifies which officers are capable enough to become senior leaders. And then when they go through to talk about standards, they say standards and culture must be improved. To improve standards and recruit the right applicants, the police need to attract and retain the right people. Unless that happens, as a risk forces may take chances and compromise on the quality of people they recruit. And then they allude to this, discipline. Discipline is a critical prerequisite for high standards. And over the past decade, to some extent, the police service has lost its discipline. In most forces, gone are the days of immaculately polished boots, ties, cravats, custodian helmets. And the Uplift programme has led to the creation of a much younger workforce who come from a different generation and may have different expectations over standards of appearance. But first impressions are important. And if the police want to be seen as professional, they need to look professional. And if they don't get the standards right of appearance, it raises much wider questions around standards extending to other aspects of policing, such as investigations, which appears in all the Peel reports now as an area for improvement, victim care, integrity, courtesy and professionalism. It's a bit of a impactful paragraph.
It's a smorgasbord there, but rightly so, really, because a lot of this comes under the sort of same umbrella, doesn't it? Few issues, really. So some of the issues around recruitment currently. I think it's utterly predictable that if you are, you know, the political imperative is 20,000 police officers within a set period of time, you will hit that number or you'll be financially penalised. That's, you know, that's the environment in which 20,000 student officers have been brought into policing. we have to welcome that investment. And I think over the next few years, you know, that we will see that come to fruition in the way that workforce planning across forces is improved because of the uplift, and much required uplift in officer numbers. But I look at something like recruitment and degree entry. I've alluded to, I did a piece of work, just an independent review, really, evaluation of how that had landed with the University of South Wales and the five forces that they work with. And what really disappointed me was, you know, degree entry policing. Well, whether you agree with it or you don't, and I do, for various reasons, and I say that as somebody who left school at 16 with no qualifications at all, and I still have no educational qualifications other than a few CSEs from when I was 16 years of age. So I left policing as an assistant chief constable with no real professional recognition in terms of qualifications. So I think it's important that professionalising policing, that opportunity is there for student officers, and all the time constraints and all of that is a different debate. Protected learning time and all of that being honoured is a different debate. Getting back to the point, what I find really, really disappointing is, you know, having had the debate for years, you know, not just as the MPCC, but as ACPO prior to that, and having agreed that this was important for policing, within 2 to 3 years of introduction, there are chief constables who are openly criticising the requirement for their officers to go through a degree process. And I just think I just find that inexcusable, really, because those officers are still going through a degree that their chief constable has openly said, publicly said, is a waste of time. So that shows you an inconsistency for me in leadership that I just think is a disservice to those individuals who are going through that process, because the debate has been had and it's time to move on. And if your officers are subjected to that degree entry, they should be supported through that, because if the chief constable doesn't support it, it's hardly surprising that the sergeant is not affording protecting learning time that is causing the time, you know, the time issues that those students, it all goes downhill, isn't it? Okay. I've ranted a bit there, so I apologise. Retention, I think, is a key strategic threat for the service going forward and should not be underestimated. And again, that brings us back to a society of policing within society being constantly criticised from mainstream media, from mainstream politicians, across the board. Very rarely do I see policing held up in a positive light by anybody with an opinion. Well, that is going to make recruitment difficult and certainly make retention difficult. So they're key strategic issues for the service. I don't have all the answers to sort that out, and I'm sure those discussions are taking place elsewhere. With regards to standards, and I do think this is really important, because people see it's like the broken windows theory, isn't it? You know, if this is allowed to be seen as acceptable, this level of dress, this level of investigatory standard, well, don't be surprised when everybody else drops to that level. You know, that's human nature. Broken windows theory sort of outlines that, doesn't it? And what I would say with regards to standards, and I'm ex-army, I appreciate that. I did a few years in the army, and do you know what? I had bald boots or shoes for my entire 30 years service as a police officer. That was my personal sort of the standards I wanted to set myself. And before I get into the crux of this, we should recognise there's a generational gap here. So I have retired from the service, I'm in my mid-50s, it's hardly surprising that my opinion around standards, and if we're talking about standards of appearance, hairstyles, piercings, tattoos, etc., it's not surprising that as a middle-aged bloke, frankly, with unconscious biases, I have a view around that will differ from student officers joining at 22 years of age. So, you know, you have to account for that. There's no right or wrong here, which gets me to the crux of the matter and the leadership crux of this issue. And if we take one specific example, because it's been widely, you know, publicised and in the media, and I'm not going to name names or anything because I don't know them, frankly, but you have a Bedfordshire police officer, the 24 hours in police custody programme. I didn't even see it because I was out of the country, but I've seen some of the fallout, and most of it is around the appearance of the officer and nothing to do with the excellent police work that was portrayed in the programme. Therein lies some of the issue. Now, for me, it's pretty straightforward. If we use this as an example, there's either a leadership permission here or there's a leadership failure, and I'll explain why. I can't think of any force in the country that doesn't have a force policy around standards of appearance, standards of dress. They will either have an all-encompassing policy that covers then things such as tattoos, hair, so on and so forth, or they will have a number of different policies pretty much covering all of the same issues, all around standards, standards of appearance, standards of dress in public. Now, if a chief constable decides that this stuff is not important, they can rip that policy up. They have the autonomy to rip that policy up. It's entirely within their gift to do that. And if they do that, and, you know, there's a bit of a free-for-all, and people, officers, turn up for work with Mohicans and facial piercings and, you know, visible tattoos in the facial area and so on and so forth, well, if the chief constable's decided that this stuff doesn't really matter, I'm not going to criticise that. That's within their gift. I'm of a different generation. I might have a personal view on that, but my opinion on that, frankly, is irrelevant. If a chief constable decides that that's what they want within their force, then fine. Crack on with it. And I'm assuming if you make that decision, you've considered trust and confidence in policing, so on and so forth, right? So crack off. The problem I have is I don't think any forces have got rid of policies around standards. So if it's not a leadership permission, there's a leadership failing because there's a policy. Most forces will be able to pull a policy off the shelf that makes it perfectly clear. It might be a bit vague in the detail. It's not going to mention Mohicans, but it'll certainly mention standards of haircut, what it was expected. We'll make it perfectly clear to officers and to leaders, more importantly, what is the accepted position in this force. And if the force policy says quite clearly that wearing a Mohican in the workplace breaches that force policy, and yet the officer or officers consider they're allowed to do that, and that's not challenged at sergeant, inspector, superintendent, chief officer level, well, it's a leadership failure then, isn't it? Either the policy is there, and it's there for a reason, or it's not. So if you're giving permission, that's fine. If you're not, then I think leaders at sergeant, inspector level should act with the confidence and the backing of their chief constable, because it's the chief constable's force policy, in addressing that and dealing with that. And if they just acquiesce to that, don't be surprised when there's, you know, a degrading of standards across the board.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of value in what you said, a lot of food for thought there. And I think particularly for supervisors, first line supervisors, when you mentioned the word backing, I think that's one of the things they will say is, look, you know, part of a sergeant's role and functions and directions is discipline on their team. And they will, if they do that, they will need the support of their inspector to do that, and so on and so forth up the line. And I think some of the criticisms have been, perhaps along with some of that culture of acquiescence around standards of dress and tattoos. And as you say, you can always go offline and have those discussions as part of organisational chats as to where you want that standard to be. But I think a lot of the supervisors, and certainly some of the anecdotal and real conversations I've had around some of those issues, is they don't always get the support they need.
Yes.
And they do the job they're expected to do. Yeah. There and then. It's a case of, it's a lot easier to challenge the sergeant for bullying or whatever, when in fact all they're doing is enforcing or trying to remind and persuade and drive up standards.
And I don't want to focus on that one particular officer. There are other examples you could give, but this has been one that's been you know, front and centre within the media recently. Yeah. And I suppose my thinking is, that officer, I'm assuming Beds Police has a force policy in place for standards, okay? I'm assuming that officer knew that he was stretching the limits of what's allowable within that policy.
I think the tweet itself, Paul, had about nearly 4 million views, and I think, to be
this
fair, some of their supervisors came out and said it was something to do with a charity or it was something to do with a sponsored thing, which is fine if that's the explanation for it. I think it's about other issues around, like you said, around editorial control and what that looks like, trust and confidence on TV.
Well, yeah, it's about 4 million hits. Not many people are going to read the, you know, the comeback from a few officers who have said this, you know, who have applied the context of that. Yeah. What's the force response to that? Because I haven't seen one. I haven't seen a response. There may well be one, but this is the point. There's been 4 million views, and I pay an interest in this stuff, and I don't recall seeing any response from the force involved. You know, and this is why this stuff is important. Now, if you don't think it is, fine, rip up the force policy and have the moral courage to back up, you know, what you're suggesting is acceptable. But if there's a policy there that's been openly breached and leaders don't feel they are confident enough to address that, you know, at what point? So the sergeant and inspector presumably have not addressed that. The superintendent will be well aware of it and has not addressed it. I'm damn sure the chief officers, the first time they were aware of it was not when it ended up on national television. So what's been done about it? You know, if nobody is addressing this, I come back to my, you know, initial view. It's either a leadership permission or it's a leadership failure. And it's important because there's 4 million views there. And what's really depressing, and I understand this guy is a really good police officer, right? And I've got nothing to counteract that at all. The white noise around his hairstyle completely removed any positive news about the fantastic police work that had been undertaken. Well, the service shouldn't put itself in that position. That's what policy procedure's for. That's what leadership is about. You know, and if you can't have those conversations, well, where do you draw the line? How can you then have conversations around misogyny, around sexual inappropriateness in the workplace? Do you know what I mean? And I go back to it's a bit of a weak analogy, but broken windows theory. If this stuff is seen to be permissible, it will only get worse.
And it's not. The police isn't the military, and yet, even though a lot of people say we should adopt a lot of military practices in things like promotion and tests and other things, it's not the military. It shouldn't be the military. The police are the public, and they're recruited from the public, and there has to be that issue around there. But when you do join the military, you know, you are inducted, you're shown what the standard is, the standard of dress, the standard of uniform, standard of drill, what expectations are, what consequences are, so that when they show you how to wash yourself, because people come from all diverse walks of life, they come in and a corporal will stand there naked in front of you and show you how to wash your body in detail, demonstrate how to shave correctly and keep your razor clean. And then the very next day, if you don't withhold from the very next day forward, if you don't withhold those standards and you start slipping, there are consequences, and they're felt very quickly. You're either cleaning out the lavatories for a month, you are confined to camp, no leave or docked pay. And I think that's what I feel when I look at this and go, you know, the HMIC says that discipline has gone from policing in most forces. I think I look at that and think back to that from my perspective and think it's not those individuals' fault. If they were inducted properly and shown what the standard is, particularly if nothing else, as sergeants on promotion, there you go. You've been rechipped, recalibrated, refocused around the expected standards and the consequences. Now go ahead and lead your teams. I think something around there, because I don't think sergeants are at fault, or first-line supervisors, sometimes second-line supervisors are at fault. I think it's around, as you said, probably an acquiescence around standards that has been left.
I wouldn't blame any sort of layer of you know, the rank structure or the hierarchy. I think it's a systemic acquiescence. And that, you know, that, don't be surprised. Don't be surprised if you see behaviours you really don't want to see. If you acquiesce to the stuff that is blatantly in front of you and you're just ignoring it. You know, and there is something about rebalancing for me there.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. I know we've covered quite a lot, and I really appreciate your time with this one, Paul, but we're covering a lot of ground here and a lot of food for thought for people. I'd just like to kind of come to last bit, you know, a bit more around you and what your perspectives are. So in relation to, you know, attributes that you've seen in people you personally consider to be good leaders.
Yeah.
What was it about them and, you know, that resonated with you?
So I look back on a service, and you know, there are some key individuals, aren't there? So my first ever sergeant, I can recall from 30 plus years ago. You know, my first inspector when I joined down in Cornwall, a guy who's, you know, I'm still in touch with, my wife is still in touch with on the old social media. My BCU commander when I was on the first time I was an SMT member on a BCU. Chief constable when I was the staff officer for the chief constable down in Cornwall. There are individuals that, you know, you learn a lot from. And I suppose on a personal level, they struck me as people who cared. Genuinely cared. That's how it came across. So if they didn't, they were pretty good at suggesting they cared. They cared about me as an individual, not about me, just me professionally. They were fair in their dealings with me. They always made me feel, even if they had to let me down, they always made me feel that I've been treated fairly. When we come back to promotion processes, yeah, that's important. They didn't look down on me. You know, and the choice of language, I think, sometimes is really important. I never ever, at any stage in my career, I don't ever recall, and if I did, I apologise, referring to officers as my officers. They're not my officers. You know, I might be the assistant chief constable, but they're not my officers. They're my colleagues. You know, they're our officers, as I'm an officer within the organisation. They're not mine, and it's just subtle use of language. You know, they didn't look down on me. These leaders that I remember, they were polite in their dealings with me. Even if, as I say, even if you can get a rollicking from somebody and come out with it thinking, that was fair, and at least they were polite and treated me with respect. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a gift there. You know, there's a leadership gift there. And in terms of leadership and what I saw from them, they knew their business, both operationally and as you go further, into the rank system. They knew their business strategically as well. And that's something I think is really important. They were strategically astute. They understood the broader picture and where they fitted in at whatever level they were at. They were decisive. And they understood and were able to deal with risk, which I think is really important. And I don't want to sit here and label a style, but there is a preferred style of being transformational. But if I was sat on a promotion board, please don't sit in front of me, and there's no reason why you would now, because I'm retired, and say you're transformational, but you can dip into transactional. Because in answer to a question, that's not going to be good enough. But they're the qualities that I saw from those leaders who impacted on me and influenced me.
So on a board, you could say that, but you'd want to hear a lot more about their personal perspective on it, their personal take on it.
If that's your strap line, you know, transformational, dip into transactional, that's fine. What does that mean for you as a leader?
Yeah.
Individualize that. Get into the detail of that. What's going through your head when you're making really difficult decisions? And not just operational decisions, because a lot of the difficult stuff, the further you get, you know, into policing and higher in the ranks, a lot of the HR stuff is more challenging, actually, than the operational stuff.
People issues, I think that links there, Paul, to one of the other. I mean, you may have covered some of this, you may not, but what would you say changes most? I call this crossing the Rubicon in my way, when you move from the federated ranks into superintendent ranks and beyond. What would you say changes most, or what needs to change when you're promoted from the inspecting or the federated ranks to superintendent beyond? What's the key difference, if there is one?
So, again, none of this is meant to be criticism. I've seen some of the best inspectors who remain at that rank, and they remain there for a reason. They're bloody brilliant at what they do. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, quality of individual is not necessarily, don't ever be defined by your rank, I suppose, in headline terms, because your rank is almost insignificant. It's what you are as a leader and what you bring to the table. Okay. Getting back to the question, what do I think is the main difference? I do think at the superintendent level and above, that strategic awareness becomes important, becomes really important. And what do we mean by that? Because we bandy the word around. I think if you just take policing out of it for a moment, if you were a senior level manager in an organisation with a £400 million a year budget that employs 6,500 people across a massive geographic area, you need to be strategically astute to understand the business of running that. And that, I think, sometimes is lacking within policing. There's a reason why the Strategic Command Course had a business module as well as an operational one. And in my experience and on reflection, I think what we see very often in policing is people who are very, very good operationally. The people you want to ring at 2 a.m. with a firearms job because you know they're going to do a great job at a tactical command level, even a strategic firearms command level. And they're going to really help the operational delivery of that. So they're excellent at the operational side of things. But don't give them a project to balance your books around budget, because they haven't got the strategic astuteness and awareness to do that. You know, they haven't got the broader political awareness. So I think superintendent and above, you need to be both operationally credible, but you also need to be strategically astute and aware and understand the business element of running a large organisation. If you get both of those together, you tend to end up with a really, really competent senior officer. I'm not saying I had that, and I'm sure there would be a lot of people who would suggest I didn't. But in my head, that's what I wanted from me as a competent senior officer.
Yeah.
Somebody who operationally can be relied upon and is credible, but sort of understands that this is a big business.
So as a inspector, chief inspector, then you'd be looking to develop that set of skills as part of your CPD if you were intent on moving in.
Yeah, and I think that broader thinking at any level is a good thing. You know, it gives you a different perspective, and I tell you, stepping away from policing also gives you that different perspective. And trouble is, in the cut and thrust of the day-to-day job, it's very difficult for those, in those positions to step back and just reflect and sort of think, okay, well, so let's look at how other organisations, for example, deal with reasonable adjustments. Because none of this is new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's having that sort of broader sort of awareness. You know, if you're in a strategic partnership, tap up the partners. Try and understand how their organisations operate. Try and understand the myriad of National Health Service management sort of structure. And try and learn from that and try and bring that back into, if you're in a superintendent, chief superintendent level, you need to be as astute from a business point of view as operationally credible, in my view. And if you're developing yourself to go forward for those ranks, then the broader your thinking at a very early stage, the better. Because this should almost be a natural progression. It's not something you should... I think it's not something... Being strategically aware is not something you can just coach yourself for a promotion process because you get found out pretty quickly, actually. You either know what you're talking about or you don't.
Mm.
And I do think my view has always been that the long-term strategic planning within policing, and I felt this when I was there, so it's not a criticism, it's an observation. The long-term strategic planning within policing is at best a work in progress.
Mm.
And that's the area, and that's why the business module within the strategic command course wasn't the sexy bit. But for me, and for a lot of others that I went through that course with, it was the bit that was most beneficial to us.
So when the forces looking, when police forces are looking to bring the right skill set in at entry point, if you like, and yes, there are direct entry routes, what are your thoughts? There's a little question I've got there, if I could ask it, is what are your views on rank skipping for talented individuals or those that have the skill set? Do you think that there should be a case for or a mechanism for rank skipping as they do in the FBI and other organisations? Or do you think that those people should come in at a administrative level for the function that you're asking to be covered?
I experienced that in Devon, Cornwall. You know, two colleagues did skip from inspector to superintendent. Both did a good job. I can't speak for them. I reckon that would have been challenging for them in the early phases. Both did a good job. Both of them ended up as assistant chief constables. So that worked. I'm sure there will be anecdotal evidence elsewhere that suggests that it hasn't worked. I don't have too much of an issue with that, to be honest. If you can seek out the most talented people within your organisation, but you have to do that. If you're going to take that approach, there will be some fallout from that, you know, not least from people who are trying to do the traditional route, if you like, and not least because you will have people who fail, who are given that opportunity and then, you know, for whatever reason, struggle with it. So, but getting back to your question, the crux of your question, I don't have a problem with that. It does come with a level of fallout that you need to understand. And if you can explain that, if you understand why you're doing that, then why not do it? Have the moral courage to do it, you know? And I come back to, never be defined by your rank. You know, your rank doesn't show your competence. Your rank doesn't show your skills and abilities. Your rank just happens to be what you wear on your shoulder at that level of the organization. It doesn't make you a good leader. You know, I've seen many people who have been overpromoted compared with their skills and abilities, you know. Too many people get obsessed with the rank, I think. And police staff have a view on this because, of course, they don't have that sort of obvious rank structure. We can get too hung up on the rank. So skipping rank, I don't have an issue with this if it's the right people for the right reason. But it does come with a level of fallout you need to appreciate.
Okay, well, listen, we've covered a lot of ground, like we said, and a lot of issues and topics. I've got one last question. I don't call it, and I would never seek to ambush anybody, but it's just a gentle one, that if you were to join today and you could go back to that young officer that joined the service, what would you say to yourself on reflection in light of all your experience?
Do you know what? I think the service, so if people serving now think that the service is under, you know, unfair scrutiny, is being criticised from all levels, frankly, it was ever thus. And it goes through peaks and troughs, but frankly, it was ever thus. My wife joined with me 30 years ago, and she will recall she turned up at Torquay Police Station on her first day, and the old DS was coming out the back of the station and said, "I don't envy you joining this lot at this moment in time." You know, well, that was 35 years ago. So it was ever thus. You know, UK policing, I think, is the best in the world. It's been tested, and it's the best in the world. The people that are voluntarily putting themselves forward to be serving police officers and police staff, by and large, are quality people. At the moment, there's too many cases being put forward that denigrate that, because they show the very worst of the police of the public and the public of the police, because they're showing the bad people. I was involved in countless misconduct proceedings and gross misconduct hearings. You have some stupid people and you have a small number of bad people. The people serving today, the officers and staff today who are serving, who by and large are really, really dedicated and committed to providing a public service, deserve the support of the public. And at the moment, I fear that, you know, the rhetoric is going against them as opposed to with them. That will change, and I think there's a big leadership role at the top of the service to enable that to change and to reason that rhetoric and influence that rhetoric more. But getting back to your question, because I've gone off script yet again, enjoy it. It's fantastic. What a great way to earn a living. And again, it's not about rank. My wife stayed at the constable rank, but had a far more varied career than I did. You know, the opportunities available to you are unlike most other occupations that you would fall into. And even on those really bad days, when you think, you know, this couldn't get much worse, well, just have a step back and reflect and think, do you think it's any better in any other organisation? You know, is it, you know, this environment is challenging, but try and enjoy it. Be proud of it, because, you know, you've been given an opportunity that a load of people who would really want to do don't have the opportunity or can't reach the required standard to do. So just enjoy it. Just be proud. Just serve the public, and, you know, and see what comes of it, you know. And again, if you want to go for a promotion, well, go for it. If you get knocked back, like I did 8 times, well, learn from it, you know. Don't get bitter and twisted about it, because it could be a lot worse. And I think I have extraordinary respect for serving police officers and staff. It pains me when I see retired cops ranting, as they do daily, on social media about denigration of, you know, recruits and so on and so forth. They should just shut up, really, because the service deserves their support. Anyway.
that's a good point to finish, particularly if you are listening into that. And I think the main thing for me that I've just come across from you, Paul, and thank you for sharing so many points, is your personal resilience in what you've done as you've gone through. And I think there's a big issue there with knockbacks, setbacks, and people being, you know, taking that as anything other than a learning experience as part of a broader aim or objective to achieve promotion as part of your personal and professional development. So resilience is the thing that comes back to me with that, and thank you very much. And as I say, on behalf of the listeners, thanks ever so much for your being so generous with your time, and I wish you all the best on your travels. I know you're traveling out and about all over the place, and on behalf of the listeners, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And for those of you listening, I will be back with another podcast in due course. And until then, take care and stay safe.
If you made it this far, thanks for listening, and I hope you found that helpful. Let me know your views in the podcast details and Q&A section, or by tweeting me or Xing me, as it is, @rank_success. If you or a colleague have something interesting to contribute on policing, promotion and or leadership, by all means, please get in touch. I'm always happy to share my platform to promote a diverse range of perspectives in policing whilst creating informative content for you. If you like this podcast, please consider becoming a subscriber Not only will you be helping to ensure I can continue creating free content for everyone, but for just $4.99 a month, you'll also get a load of great stuff on top. This no hassle, cancel anytime offer provides extra subscriber only episodes, priority access to all new episodes, and access to the best of my back catalogue. Should you want to go further and hit the ground running, you'll also receive an exclusive 25% discount on my market leading structured promotion materials to help focus your effort. If you want in-person support, check out my website for upcoming masterclass dates. I only do a few a year, but they're action-packed with targeted support. You'll leave with great clarity on your forced promotion process and with all the tools you need for success. Attendees most often describe the day as inspiring, informative, and motivating. Others have said it cuts through the fear of fog, confusion, and nerves, and one went so far as to say, "It's the best money I ever spent on my own promotion development. Gave me the right frame of mind and motivation to succeed, second to none." So all the best in your career aspirations. You can see a suite of support on my website at ranksuccess.co.uk, plus my popular free blogs at policepromotion.blog. Until next time, take care and stay safe.